I think that's right. And I think my role and where I'm most comfortable is focusing on the economic harms, that the choices that this administration is making will limit access to affordable, clean energy, affordable energy overall, and that they will wind up harming the American people. EDF is standing up and fighting the Trump administration in court every single day. And we believe, based on the facts and the law, that we have very good cases and expect to see more wins than not. Because when the government sets aside all of the things that they need to do to land in an appropriate way and just say, we don't care, this is what Donald Trump wants, there's recourse to step in and intervene and challenge that. And they were sloppy the first time he was president. They're even more brazen now.
My guest, David Kiva, has been on the front lines of some of the most critical environmental debates of our time before becoming president of EDF Action, the advocacy and political arm of the Environmental Defense Fund. He was in the White House as the director of public engagement at the Council on Environmental Quality. But his journey to the West Wing started on the campaign trail, where he was tasked with a unique role convincing a broad coalition of voters that Joe Biden was the candidate to tackle the climate crisis. He is a strategist who understands not just the science of climate, but what it takes to implement those policies. David Kiva, welcome to One Planet Podcast and the Creative Process.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here. And what a warm and generous introduction. I'm not sure I'm worthy of it, but really, thank you.
Well, you know, you've really done a lot. I mean, unfortunately, in recent years, some of those achievements, those milestones have been set back. But you work to embed environmental justice into the core of federal policy. The Trump administration is, you know, closed the EPA's environmental justice offices. The Justice 40 initiative was a landmark step. So how does EDF Action plan to continue fighting for environmental justice when the federal apparatus designed to address all these issues is really being dismantled? It must be frustrating with all these rollbacks. How do you, you know, work to support frontline communities directly when federal government is no longer an ally?
That's a great question. It's one that we think about all of the time, and environmental justice remains a core focus of the Environmental Defense Fund. I think it has to remain a core focus of the Environmental Defense Fund because EDF is an organization that has its basis in science and economics. So we are not interested in addressing inequities in terms of health outcomes because of some sort of social engineering project. We are interested in addressing inequities in health outcomes because it's what the science and the air monitoring tell us. Environmental justice may not be a priority of this administration. They paint with a very broad brush to describe it in very unfair and unkind terms, but it certainly continues to be a core focus of EDF's, and we've got some great people working on it.
Yeah. And another focus is addressing those daily costs. What's really hitting us now, we're beginning to see, and what makes it more difficult because the administration has canceled tax credits for clean energy projects, is really like actively promoting fossil fuels. So all these market signals that were so promising under the Inflation Reduction Act have been reversed. So how does EDF Action pivot its strategy from supporting a growing clean energy economy to defending the gains already made, and at the same time pushing back against this new drill baby drill doctrine? Where do we see those opportunities for market-based solutions when you just don't have that federal government support incentivizing them?
Those are challenges and questions we think about every single day. I love that sort of the rallying cry of the One Planet podcast is that the only thing we can't do is nothing. We agree completely with that. And I think we have an important role to play in educating your audience, educating the broader public about just what's going on and just what the impacts will be on them. What your audience probably knows, but that very few people out in America do, is that 93% of new generating capacity that came online in the power sector last year came from renewable sources or from batteries. And if you've got an administration that is trying actively to stomp out clean energy at absolutely every turn, someone's going to have to pay for that. And that someone, unfortunately, is American taxpayers or American ratepayers. So what we saw in the 2024 election was effectively the American people spoke loudly and said that they thought that things cost too much in this country. And they voted for Donald Trump because they thought that he would do something about it. He's moving us in the wrong direction, not the right direction, especially as it relates to energy prices, which is a story in Newsweek just this past week revealed are rising at a rate higher than inflation for groceries, higher than the rate of inflation for housing. The decisions that President Trump and his administration are making every single day are hurting the American people and their wallets. And the polling that EDF Action has conducted has indicated that they don't like it.
Exactly. And you've pointed to solar as a game changer. And you know, I agree with this, the recent explosion in solar capacity, but also the other renewable sources is a reason for hope. But the scale is everything. So how do we accelerate the deployment of solar and other renewables at a pace that actually meets the climate timelines, you know, without being slowed down? Because there is this process of permitting and grid infrastructure and political opposition.
That's exactly right. I think the first thing we've got to do is clear roadblocks from this administration is creating by very, very clearly pointing out what the impacts will be on the American people from the policy decisions that they're making. So that's the first thing that I think about every single day when I get up. We're also working to advance state-based solutions. I talk almost every single day with our California state director who's working on a really important Western grid integration bill. That is a very live issue in California, and it's also working on reauthorization of the state's landmark cap and trade law, which we hope to renew for another 10 years or longer before this legislative session ends. So in places where it's possible for us to move the needle and make meaningful progress to reduce emissions, with California being number one on the list because it's our most populous state and the state with the most economic activity, that's exactly what we're focused on. In other places where the political winds seem to be blowing in a different direction, lots and lots of focus is on Texas these days, as it should be. We've mostly focused on a defensive effort to keep bad bills that would seem intended to squelch out clean energy from taking root, because Texas has been an energy success story for a very, very long time in terms of leading the nation in development of clean energy. Part of that was spurred by its adoption when George W. Bush was governor, before he was even president, of a renewable portfolio standard. EDF was at the center of developing that and helping to bring it on. But we were also really pleased when it very quickly became obsolete because Texas exceeded its generation targets at every single turn. So when we as a country or as a set of states put our shoulder to the wheel and decide that we're going to do something, technology and advances can happen very, very quickly and far faster than anyone thought.
Yeah. And another of the solutions, although I had thought it was far off, but, you know, we just had Rebecca Tickle, the environmental documentary filmmaker, come to talk about regenerative agriculture on our show. And I guess that's approaching a tipping point in terms of not a lot of people realize, but regenerative agriculture can draw down the teraton of carbon we're emitting into our atmosphere and do that at scale, you know, as long as people get behind it. I mean, it's growing gradually, but she says we're heading towards a tipping point and a lot of awareness on that now, too.
That's great. You and she are doing an awful lot to raise awareness on that. One of the things that EDF has long worked on is a basis and an understanding that we're not going to make progress just by convincing people who are already convinced and who are doing what they ought to be doing. We've worked with some of the firms that are some of the largest emitters. EDF is central to the development of something called the Dairy Methane Ag Alliance, which is working to bring down agricultural emissions from methane via voluntary partnerships with huge dairy producers around the world. We've worked with oil and gas producers around their commitments to eliminate methane emissions. I spent a bunch of time with Abigail Spanberger, a former congresswoman who's running for governor of Virginia, who is an absolute champion on climate smart agriculture issues when she was in Congress, and I'm convinced would be the same when and if she's governor of Virginia, which we'll find out about in November, and which we hope she will be the next governor of Virginia.
So tell us about climate champions.
Climate champions are everywhere and they don't all look or sound the same. EDF Action, as the political partner or C4 of the Environmental Defense Fund, one of the tools in our toolkit is we can be a little bit more leaned in and participate in elections. So we've organized under the banner of Climate Voters Unite for the past several years. We've turned out more volunteers and EDF Action members to participate in elections, showing up at the times when climate champions need us most, in the places where they need us most, to do the hard work that helps to win elections. I myself get anxious around election season, and I've found the only cure for that anxiety is to grab a packet and go out and knock doors and talk to voters. It's the only foolproof method that I have for feeling like I'm participating in a meaningful way and getting out there and talking to folks. So you can educate someone who knows nothing about climate, but that might have some speed bumps and take some time. And we do a little bit of that. But helping to make sure that people who are seeking office, whether they're running for city council or state legislature or Congress or president, are motivated by a belief that we need to do something to address the climate crisis. That's a little bit, it kind of short circuits the system a little bit, because you know that someone's motives are already aligned with yours, and you know that they're likely to do the right thing if they get to office. We've had a pretty good success rate at electing climate champions, and it's happened all over this country.
Yeah, and they have the charisma and the energy, and people just want to see that momentum, and they know it's right. I mean, everyone in the back of their mind, whether they're saying or whether they're affected by lobbies or whatever, you just know common sense that it's not right to trash the planet that you live on for yourself or for future generations. You just know that that's wrong. So that you just have to tap into that sense of right and the sense of energy for those leaders going forward. So you talked about winning elections. The political fight over climate is now more intense than ever. The administration using those executive orders and regulatory changes to swiftly reverse years of policy. So what for you is the most critical lesson you've learned from this new wave of deregulation and the environmental movement? How can we apply this to win future political battles? I mean, what's, what kind of strategy you see for building that broad coalition against an administration that is just actively targeting states and cities that pursue their own climate agendas? And can climate still be part of a winning presidential campaign?
I think that's a very good question. And the first thing that I would encourage folks to do is take a deep breath. I do not believe that the 2024 election was a referendum on climate. What I said consistently in the run-up to the election is, of course, climate matters, because so much of the progress that was made over the past 4 years on economic recovery and on rebuilding has been intertwined with the administration's commitments on climate. I've never seen an election that wasn't a referendum to some degree on the economy. What we saw was that the policies that we enacted over the past 4 years of the Biden administration were working, and they were working really, really well. And there's been some acknowledgement from that from some strange corners. CBS News just issued a report, and we'll make sure we share it with you, that showed the internal analysis that EPA did about removing something called the endangerment finding, which I'd be happy to discuss if you'd like to, would actually raise gas prices for American consumers, and it would cost as many as 500,000 American manufacturing jobs. You can't make sort of ideologically based decisions to privilege and promote pollution that harm the American people and not expect that to have some political consequence. So the 2024 election was absolutely not a referendum on climate. It wasn't a refutation of climate priorities. To the degree that the American people were speaking, what they were saying was that they would like for costs to go down. We're seeing actions taken by this administration that go completely in the opposite direction. And I feel really powerfully that not just an opportunity, but an obligation to raise my voice and leverage some of the expertise within my organization so that everyone is aware of exactly what has happened.
Yeah, the trouble is that there's, you know, segments of society that are suspicious of expertise. So considering the administration's decision to rescind the EPA's endangerment finding and gut regulatory protections, how do you organize and mobilize a response to this kind of foundational attack just on the very basis of environmental law?
I think that's right. And I think my role and where I'm most comfortable is focusing on the economic harms, that the choices that this administration is making will limit access to affordable, clean energy, affordable energy overall, and that they will wind up harming the American people. We've got a president who's very quick to dismiss any statistic that he doesn't like as being fake news. The problem with that is that the American people are living their real lives. And when they see their energy bills go up, they're going to ask why. And I'd like to continue to provide a little bit of context and expertise and rationale behind it. But you're absolutely right. There's a deep, deep mistrust of institutions these days because people look around and they've not seen them helping their lives. I'd imagine you're familiar with it, but in the Republican budget bill that just passed that President Trump championed, there was an 11th hour insertion of a tax subsidy for metallurgical coal. And that's exactly the type of thing that further erodes faith in institutions and trust in government. And it should, because nobody knew where this thing came from. Nobody quite knew who had asked for it. And it was a funny little thing because it wasn't a big enough subsidy to encourage production of additional metallurgical coal, thank goodness. It was effectively just a transfer of money from the American taxpayers to the companies that are already producing coal, which, by the way, is sent overseas to make foreign steel that winds up being a competitor to U.S.-made steel, which tends to be cleaner. So it runs antithetical to President Trump's stated goals. It doesn't make a whole lot of economic sense, and it does a lot to instill a lack of confidence, rightly, in government and our process. At a time when people, as you pointed out, don't trust institutions, pointing to this type of backroom deal as evidence that our government is not working to advance the interests of the American people, but of small special interests.
Yeah, exactly. It's about getting that messaging right because, yes, as you say, the election wasn't a referendum on the environment. It was, I think it came from a lot of people feeling left out, this urban-rural divide, and the everyday costs were important to them, but it didn't quite line up with, I believe, what the solutions were offered by both candidates on the table. So your work involves these, you know, connecting that climate policy to everyday costs. And so how do you at the EDF Action ensure that those economic benefits of a clean energy transition and the political messaging around it reach those most vulnerable communities, those communities that may, you know, be Trump voters now, often in rural areas who are already dealing with crumbling infrastructure and getting the first impacts of climate change? Those benefits of sustainability just don't benefit the suburbs or urban centers.
That's exactly right. And that's exactly what programs like the Solar for All program, which was targeted yesterday, according to a New York Times story by the Trump administration, for the government to effectively renege on commitments that they made to community-based groups to help them install solar. The Trump administration, the first time he was president, had a spectacularly poor record in court. We're seeing a lot of confidence in them based on the reshaping of the Supreme Court and the fact that Trump appointed three Supreme Court justices. But at the end of the day, the facts and the law matter tremendously. EDF is standing up and fighting the Trump administration in court every single day. And we believe, based on the facts and the law, that we have very good cases and expect to see more wins than not. Because when the government sets aside all of the things that they need to do to land in an appropriate way and just say, we don't care, this is what Donald Trump wants, there's recourse to step in and intervene and challenge that. And they were sloppy the first time he was president. They're even more brazen now.
Yeah. And on the other hand, I think it was a real reckoning for the Democratic Party and realizing that for whatever the faults of this new incarnation of the Republican Party, that they are good at messaging, or they are good at triggering their base and even beyond, even voters that were traditionally considered Democratic voters, there, you know, with this rage, this, you know, it's much easier to dismantle and tear apart something and hit people's emotional triggers than to build something, to build those coalitions, to reach across. Renewable energy has become cheaper in many states. And in the long term, an investment is the ultimate cheap because it's renewable. But it is hard. You do have to strategize about that, like any change. And so maybe it's just easier to dismantle and trigger hate and all that.
Well, it's always been easier to break something than to build something. Building something is really, really hard, but it's also incredibly meaningful. And that's what we're focused on every single day. I was at a family gathering in Vidalia, Georgia, and we flew in and out of Savannah in order to get there. It's a little over an hour away. And I was riding back with my wife and daughter and in-laws, and we passed a massive facility on Interstate 16. This is the gigantic Hyundai electric vehicle facility there. And then we kept driving up the road and wound up in a small community called Pooler, Georgia, not far from the Savannah Airport. And there were new apartment buildings all over the place. New single-family home construction all over the place. There were signs out that said, lease today or rent now or come see our demo house. All of that economic growth, the restaurants with help wanted signs in the window, were coming about because this electric vehicle facility outside of Savannah is the single largest private sector investment in the history of the state of Georgia. And I'm really, really grateful for the fact that we were able to preserve the manufacturing tax credits that helped to make this electric vehicle facility a viable option in Georgia as opposed to some other country somewhere else. But we've certainly put a real dent on the consumer demand side by removing the $7,500 tax credit for a new electric vehicle. What EDF studies have shown over a long period of time is that electric vehicle ownership is a lot more affordable than people think that it is, and that it pencils out very, very quickly. And the total cost of owning an electric car is, in most cases, a lot cheaper and better for you than buying a car that runs on gas. Most people don't know that. And so telling that story to people is an important part of what I do and of what we do. But removing powerful incentives on the consumer side, like this $7,500 tax credit, you know, that's designed to put the thumb on the scale in favor of technologies that emit more pollution and drive the climate crisis forward.
Yeah, I mean, cost savings, health savings, environmental savings, all these reasons on the plus side. And if that doesn't convince you, I mean, I know that Trump and America really loves winning. Trump is always saying about, well, we'll be winning so much that we'll get sick of winning. At the present time, China has just become the world's first electrostate. And we see the U.S., of course, is withdrawn from the Paris Agreement and UNESCO and leaving this vacuum in leadership, China to move in on climate issues, because we do need a leader to spur that change. And I don't mind whoever it is, as long as it makes it accessible in the time that we need. We need to transition quickly rather than taking forever. So just reflect then just what that signaling first about America no longer being in the Paris Agreement and UNESCO, you know, what that means. How does that affect your strategy at EDF? Or I know you're focused on America, but it does affect things.
Look, I mean, I joke, EDF Action is entirely innately focused on America and American politics. So my joke is that I'm a domestic cat and they don't let me out of the house very often. But it has been a source of pride to see America step into a leadership role in addressing the climate crisis that we, as the historical largest emitter in the world, have done so much to create. And I think the word that you used is absolutely accurate, abdication. We are abdicating our opportunity and our position of global leadership right now. I believe that the future is clean and that clean cars powered by renewable sources are the future. I believe that they're going to win out on performance. And I believe that encouraging car manufacturers to double down on the production of gas-powered vehicles that won't be competitive over time is a losing strategy because that's not where the market is heading. I believe, as we've talked a little bit about solar power, but also wind, the cost competitiveness and the ability to scale really, really quickly versus other sources of energy. Most folks don't know this, but a natural gas powered power plant takes about 7 years to come online. It doesn't take anywhere near that long to throw up solar or wind power today. Over time, the future is going to be powered by clean energy. Whether or not America continues to play a leading role in it, it is dependent to some degree on to what extent the American people stand up, raise their voices, and say, we don't like the changes that President Trump and his group are enacting because they hurt us in our wallets and they don't align with our values.
So, yeah, exactly. And I think that I'm all for a variety of market-based solutions, you know, but also many of us see a clear link between the climate crisis and the systems of capitalism that created it, or hyper-capitalism, I should say. So do you believe we can solve the climate crisis without a fundamental rethinking of our economic system? Because I know that you often do work with corporations to find solutions.
Yeah, I don't want to not answer your question. My mom taught me that was impolite. I believe deeply, and it's ingrained in EDF, that in order to solve tricky problems, you need to work with some of the entities that are responsible for creating them. EDF has a long track record of doing that and of coming to the table and working with them in good faith. And that's going to be the approach that we continue to take. So I don't want to sidestep your question about the role of capitalism in creating the climate crisis. I guess to answer it, I would say, I don't think we're going to stop living in a capitalist society anytime soon. We're focused on working through that system as effectively as we possibly can to bring about the change that we all need.
My name is Robin Noel Phillips. I'm a retired Army officer and co-author of an anthology called World Trends and Cultural Power, Seven Experts on the Near Future. All seven authors come from different fields. My background is national security affairs, so I tend to see things through that lens. But my undergraduate degree was in geology, so I also have a grasp of the environment and large-scale planetary processes. When people think of national security, they usually think of issues relating to borders, armies, or foreign threats. But it's actually much, much broader than that. The people are what make the nation. So anything that affects the prosperity of your population is ultimately a national security issue. The purpose of government is to create conditions for their people to flourish because that is the foundation for building a strong, secure nation. You cannot build a strong, secure nation on a population which is unhealthy, or poorly nourished, poorly educated, or dealing with crumbling infrastructure or insufficient energy supply. In this interview, David touches on the work that EDF is doing with some of these big pressing issues of national security, the quality of the environment, to which I would add declining natural resources, public health, energy, the economy, even civic engagement. These are all national security issues, and the biggest one is climate change. David shows us just how important and just how interrelated these issues are and the need to raise public awareness of where we're headed with current government policies and the effects they will have on people. We may be seeing a lot of cynicism right now among voters, but people really have a lot more power than they might think. You mentioned the effect of economics, that once people understand the economic harms that will affect them directly, then they'll put pressure on companies and political leaders to go in a better direction. That pressure absolutely works. And that's what gives me hope that, as David says, the markets, which after all are made of people, will continue to go in the direction of renewable energy and other climate change solutions. My colleague Bruce Piasecki the author of Doing More with Less, describes this as the stern elephant of social change. The four legs are market pricing and technology in the lead, with corporate strategy and government regulation trailing behind. But all of it moves forward irresistibly. There is no stopping this massive forward momentum of change. We cannot avoid it through isolationism, and policy cannot succeed in holding on to obsolete technologies. Looking at the larger picture, one country can do a lot of environmental damage, but no country can single-handedly solve our climate change problems. We're all interconnected. To be effective, the vast majority of the world is going to have to work together on this. We have to be pulling in the same direction. In the end, it's all about people.
And have you seen at the COP conferences, there's so many lobbyists there. I mean, how do you counteract that? Because in order to cut through the noise, you have to get through, you know, these paid lobbyists that get so much and they really tip the scale in the wrong direction. You know, you make gains, but you're hamstrung by that.
I think advocates are going to show up. And, you know, we've talked about a capitalist system. Corporations are going to act in the interest of their bottom line. EDF is continuing to work to demonstrate to corporate actors that the decisions they make, their shareholders and customers are paying attention, and that it's in their interest to act in a way that leads towards promotion of sustainability goals, even at a time when terms like ESG are out of favor with this current administration.
So, of course, we've discussed how those tax incentives have been rescinded. So what does the average taxpayer do who has to budget for these things? Now, we know, as you mentioned, electric cars are cheaper, but there is that upfront investment, right? Because some people say, oh, well, I'll just put off until then hopefully the next Democrat gets in. And then, you know, this is the other frustration. The Republicans are elected, they undo what all those significant gains you made. So then you have to, you know, you get 4 years, or maybe lucky you get 8 years, and then you put it back and then it's dismantled. So anyway, how does the average person who is trying to balance their checkbook, who wants to make renewable energy part of their life, who wants to do good, who wants to change their diet and all these things, but is finding it harder now that those incentives aren't there, or are they there, but they're just hidden or something? Like, do we have to work harder to find them?
Well, first of all, like we talked a little bit about cars because that's an area that's familiar to me and digestible and understandable. The tax credit for electric cars, trucks, and SUVs is still on the books. It's going away really, really quickly. So if you're in the market for a new car today, don't put off for another several weeks what you might be up for doing today. And if you're not sure if an electric car fits your lifestyle or your needs, go and take one for a test drive. Like, they win out on performance. I don't have a fully electric car. Mine happens to be the only hybrid minivan on the market. Most of the time when I drive around town, my car runs on electricity. On the rare occasion when it runs out of charge and it flips over to gas, it's louder. It performs worse. You hear it, you feel it inside of the car. Like, electric cars win out on performance. They're quiet, they're efficient, they never need an oil change. What I've encouraged folks who don't have an electric car to do is, first of all, take one for a test drive. I think people will be happy with it on performance. And secondly, ask somebody who owns one if they're happy with it. EV owners are really, really happy. Similarly, tax credits for adopting solar energy in your house, retrofitting your house, making it more energy efficient. A lot of those are still on the books, but those are expiring sooner than we would have hoped. Do a little bit of research yourself. Look into what's available to you, but don't delay. You, individual, well-meaning person, didn't cause the climate crisis. You're not individually responsible for solving it. But we can all make individual decisions that help to make the world a little bit more like the one that we want to live in.
So you talked there a little bit about family. I'm wondering what started you on your journey, this life of stewardship, of responsibility to the planet and to the next generation. How did you begin?
I've always been interested in politics and in the political process. And I believe really deeply that we all have a responsibility to try to create the world that we want to live in. The way that I saw myself doing that was by helping to elect people who aligned with my values. I came to the climate movement a little bit later in life, but it had always been a thing that I was very concerned with and interested in. And having the opportunity to advocate in a leading way for changes that make a big difference in the lives of everyone has been truly the honor of a lifetime for me and been the most meaningful work that I've ever done.
And now you have children, and a lot of the young people in our project and all of us really have affected from time to time by this eco-anxiety. I mean, what is your advice to them? How to be effective advocates and not be overcome, because there's so many fires to put out, literal and metaphorical, and there's so many things to do. And how do they keep a level head? And what do you tell your children?
Yeah, well, my kids are a little young to drag them out door knocking with me. But we've talked about this subsidy for metallurgical coal and how it just breeds more cynicism in our political process. That cynicism is widespread and everywhere. And it leads people to a very rational decision that their voice doesn't matter in the political process. What I tell other folks interested in seeing the world become a little bit more like we all want it to look like is that at a time when civic participation is lower and political participation is lower, that makes your voice more important than it otherwise would have been. The number of real substantive conversations with elected officials that they have with their constituents who are informed, who know what they're talking about and who they care, that's why a lot of these people ran for office in the first place. And when you have a really substantive conversation on issues that you care about with an elected leader, you can see them reacting positively to that. And it restores some of their faith in our institutions and the institutions that they're working in. So I encourage folks to raise their voices. I encourage them to not give in to pessimism and cynicism, even though it's a very, very easy time to be pessimistic and cynical, because the only thing that has ever created change in this world is people raising their voices and demanding it. So we've got to keep doing that in spite of the fact that we sometimes worry that it falls on deaf ears. That's where I go back to some of the polling and the research that EDF Action has done. If you have an elected official who's not responding to what their constituents are telling them they want and need, that person's not going to remain in office very long as people know what the consequences of those decisions, those votes, or those administrative actions are. I don't believe that if I just walked into Donald Trump's office, the Oval Office, and sat down and had a conversation with him today, that he would do a 180 on wind and solar and on pollution. I'm not saying that's the case for any of the members of Congress who voted for this bill either, but the American people don't like the changes that the Republican Trump budget bill brought. We're going to try to communicate directly with the elected officials. If we're not able to do that, we're going to communicate directly with the American people.
Yes, you spoke there of the decline in civic engagement, political engagement. I guess what also sparked your engagement, I mean, in terms of your educational path, you know, because there's so many different solutions in terms of advocating within government or without. What inspired your journey? Who were those important teachers, mentors, collaborators said, I want to be a part of this. This is exciting. This is important work.
That's a good question. In the environmental space, not to play favorites, but EDF's general counsel, Vicki Patton, is a dear friend and a mentor to me. I've seen her show such incredible tenacity and persistence, even in the immediate aftermath of really disappointing Supreme Court decisions being handed down. She gets up and in her very next breath says, well, it's even more important that we must do this, 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 and this in order to make the world a better place. I've heard her talk eloquently and beautifully about the idea that we're not running some race where there is a finish line and we stop and we've addressed the climate crisis. We're running something that's a little bit more like a relay race, and we all have an obligation to carry that baton as far as we possibly can. She tells that story better than I could, but it's one that stayed with me. Your first question was about environmental justice. Some of the environmental justice champions who I had the pleasure of working with on the Biden campaign and then in the administration, who had kind of felt like they'd toiled in the wilderness for a very, very long time before starting to get some recognition for their work, are people who lead with such moral clarity about why they want to bring about the change in the world. Two particular leaders that meant a lot to me in my life are Dr. Cecilia Martinez and former South Carolina State Representative Harold Mitchell. They become not just leaders and teachers, but dear friends. When Cecilia was honored by Time Magazine as one of the 100 most influential people in the world, I was so happy for her, not because she sought out any recognition for herself, but because as a leader within the space of environmental justice, this was an acknowledgement that the things she had been advocating for her entire career were something that society was paying attention to and were deeming really important.
Yeah, those are really important. And I do think about this disbanding of this environmental justice. We can wait it out and wait till the next Democratic presence to perhaps reinstate some of those programs. Another thing that we think about, talking about the future of education, the future of technology, AI, which is shaking up our reality. I mean, good and bad. I mean, people say, oh, maybe it can help us balance our electric grid. That's another thing that Biden did. There were the AI regulations. Okay. So I was just wondering what your reflections are on that. It affects so many things.
I'm in the same place as the spirit of that question. I think we all need to acknowledge what we don't know. But I also think we need to acknowledge that energy demand has never been higher. It's being driven in large part by massive investments that some of the biggest tech firms in the world are making in artificial intelligence. It's not going to go away. It's important, I think, that the costs of these energy demands not be borne by ratepayers, that companies who can afford to make these investments pay for the energy that is required, and also that we not take steps to stomp out clean, renewable energy that can be used to power all of our energy needs, which unfortunately, to take us back to the Trump administration, seems exactly like what they're intent on doing. We simply don't have enough energy today to meet the growing energy demands that we have. So why in the world we would take steps to discourage or make less available energy that's been responsible for 93% of new capacity over the past year is something that doesn't make sense to me. And I'm confident it also won't make sense to the American people.
That's true. And on that note of AI, yes, it uses up so much energy. And when you think about resources, the human brain, which I'm told runs on the equivalent of like the energy to power a light bulb. But, you know, the human brain, with its fallibility and imperfect memory, manages to innovate by not having the complete picture. But AI takes from this wide scraping every time you could ask it for, like, the recipe for apple pie, and it just uses as much energy as it would if you really asked it an important question. So why can't we have, like, you don't need to take a Ferrari to the grocery store. You don't need to have that much energy all the time, just for the important things like finding, you know, solutions to diseases. You know, that's great. Now we really want the whole data set, but we don't need it for the average user. We don't need it for so many things. And why can't we fine tune that? That's what I'd like to do, because it obviously has uses, but we don't need it for every use.
I agree, but nobody's putting me in charge of figuring that piece out, Mia.
Yes. And so I see there, I mean, part of this fight for protecting our planet, protecting it for future generations, is embracing and appreciating the beauty and wonder of the natural world. I see there you have photographs on your wall of the celebrating the seasons from spring to winter. Could you share with our listeners your reflections and memories of the beauty and wonder of the natural world?
I've been talking about it a fair amount because my son, who's 11, the oldest of my two children, has been off at camp in Colorado for the past 3+ weeks. And I'm picking him up on Monday and heading down to New Mexico, which is a special place to me. I was really, really lucky in that my grandparents had a ranch. So I grew up in a city, but spent my summers largely out in nature at my other grandparents' home in New Mexico, learning to ride horses, camping, spending time outdoors. And my son is getting a sort of a similar experience this summer with his cousin and others at a Western ranch in Southern Colorado. So those experiences were absolutely formative for me. The ranch hadn't been in the family for a very long time. I learned a couple of years ago that it was burned in some of the worst wildfires in New Mexico's history. And it's impossible to not, and irresponsible to not draw the connection between the decisions that we as a society are making to allow the climate crisis to move forward and human impacts that are happening in places like the community that my grandparents were a part of.
Yeah, it's true. We have to acknowledge our role as much as also embrace the beauty of nature that inspires us for the good fight. So thank you, David Kiva and EDF Action, for sharing your passion and purpose and shining that light on those sustainability success stories, your commitment to connect climate policy to everyday costs and generate the political will required to confront the climate crisis. We all live on one planet we call home. Thank you for adding your voice to One Planet Podcast and the creative process.
It's been such a pleasure to be with you, Mia. Thank you very much for having me. It's an honor.
The Creative Process and One Planet Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interviews producers on this episode were Sophie Garnier and Robin Noel Phillips. One Planet Podcast is produced by Mia Funk. Additional production support by Katie Foster. Theme music is written and performed by Juan Sanchez. We hope you've enjoyed this program. If you'd like to get involved in One Planet Podcast and be part of the climate change solution, just follow us on Instagram on @creativeprocesspodcast and send us a DM. Thank you for listening.